This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
We may have these students as well. Is that the right call? Yesterday at this that announced. Grant, welcome back, Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan, just after noon. Thanks a ton for making the show part of your day. Thanks to our Richmond audience who joins us for the final 2 hours of the show, as always, as well. It's a shame we're not hanging out with you at training camp, but camp is ongoing. And speaking of which, we try to get you some content on the teams you care about in town, jammed into one segment every day. Call it the Blitz right here at noon. So let's start you off on the gridiron. They are camping. Chris Russell, SI Now, is covering that team, one of our insiders here on The Fan. Slashy, your thoughts on Darius Geis' arrest and immediately getting released by Washington?
Well, I didn't have a problem with it. Said that on Saturday afternoon here on my show on The Fan and wrote about it, obviously, all weekend. I know you guys, you know, I completely respect and understand your point. They probably could have been more patient, but to me, there's a lot at play here. Not only what you've said, Grant, three incidents, what Danny has said, I got it. But this goes back to, I think, when they were in Carolina. Absolutely. I know Keim reported that over the weekend. I had heard something similar to that, that either they had taken him off the board. Now, they didn't need him because of McCaffrey. They had either taken him off the board or they had a lot of strong questions and doubts about him. And I wasn't sure if they had actually physically removed him from their draft board, but it sounds like they did. And when you combine all of that, the nature of the charges, maybe what he told them, what he didn't tell them, which I think was Danny's point earlier, all of that, when you combine all of that, plus the injury history, he got hurt again on Thursday. We don't know how bad, but he got hurt in his knee again on Thursday in what turned out to be his final practice. You can't count on the guy. And why go to bat for a guy like that that's got a volatile personality? You see him all the time on social media. One minute he's happy and a bowl of peaches and taking people on dates to the movies, and the next he's yelling at people and screaming at people about, you know, how dare they question whether he's injury prone. So I don't think they had much patience to begin with him, and this was, you know, obviously the final straw, and I have no problem with it.
Russell, what's the running back room look like now? I mean, the names I'm intrigued by are Bryce Love and Antonio Gibson.
Yeah.
To Adrian Peterson, but what's the role there? How does this play out?
Right. I think, you know, assuming everybody's healthy, which is a huge assumption, as we know, but just let's use that as our benchmark. I do think, Danny, Adrian Peterson will start and get the first carry week one, September 13th against the Eagles at FedEx. This won't be like he gets, I don't think, gets scratched in week one like he did last year. So let's start with that. But as I said, you know, with the Junks this morning, and I kind of, you know, I said the same thing on Saturday again, I think by midway through the season, you know, whether that's 6, 7, 8 weeks into the season, roughly, that Bryce Love will be the money guy, will be the guy that they count on to be the bell cow, but not from a 25 carry a game type guy, from a, you know, maybe 15, 16, 17 carry a game guy if he's going and in a flow, and then also 4, 5, 6 touches or targets in the passing game, because I think that's what Bryce Love brings you. And remember, he's now been, it's been 19 months, I believe it is, since the surgery. So most of these guys, it takes them a year and a half or so to get back to feeling like their normal self. Well, he's right past that. And when he was cleared for the beginning of training camp, granted they haven't had a full practice yet, that was a really encouraging sign.
Do you think they would have cut another player? And I'm uncomfortable even using names, but let's just say one of their most consistent veteran players. Mm-hmm. Would they have cut that guy for what happened to Darius Geis and, or what he did?
No, I think what Ron said this morning, and I thought he would answer it that way, is every situation is different. I heard you guys having this conversation earlier, and I understand the reason for being uncomfortable. You never want to throw somebody's name into this mix. But the bottom line is if somebody did not have the, again, I'll use volatile history, you know, that Darius Geis had. And there's stuff, guys, that we don't even know, right? I mean... You know, I mentioned this on Friday night, and people got all mad at me. This was relayed to me through a good source that a current NFL GM, who a lot of people respect and like for what he's done with his team, said that Darius Geis in the draft process, it was relayed to me after he was drafted by the Redskins, that he was the biggest piece of bleep in that he had ever come across. I mean, that's pretty strong, right? So this wasn't just, oh, we're going to whack a guy to make an example of him just because we can't keep him because of the Washington Post thing. I think it was a lot of things thrown into the soup, if you will, into the pot mixed together that led to this. But yeah, if it's somebody with a relatively clean slate, if it's even Cody Latimer, who's one-tenth of the talent Darius Geis is, he's going to get some benefit of the doubt, especially being that Ron and his staff brought a guy like Latimer here or brought, somebody else that they brought in here, Peyton Barber, just using him as an example. And I know we don't want to throw names in, but that's the point. They bring certain people here for reasons that they have, character, personality, talent, skill set. They had no attachment at all to Darius Geis at all, and very serious charges.
Russell, we're going to keep you for a second, so hang on. Let's talk some puck, please, Tommy. We're going to do it with Chris Russell. Chris, they won. They beat Boston. It's good, but it's hard to be impressed and feel great about the way the Capitals are going about their business here, entering a marquee matchup against their former head coach, Barry Trotz, in the Isles.
Yep. I mean, obviously, yes, an encouraging sign yesterday. I think Braden's been, pretty darn good for them. Their defense is still a mess. I know you got the young kid, Farivarian, yesterday. If Radko Gudas is playing any of these games, I'm going to throw up. He just can't be in the lineup. He stinks. He's not good. Their power play absolutely needs to carry them, and it's not going to carry them unless Evgeny Kuznetsov can turn that light switch on, or somebody else big time steps up that maybe is a little bit unexpected. Not to say that Tom Wilson is unexpected, but maybe if Tommy gets on one of these five goals in seven games type of runs that he has had in his career, so he can do it. The other big thing that I would say, just watching the Islanders a lot and knowing Trotz, and it's not only Barry Trotz, it's Lane Lambert, it's Mitch Korn. Those were three big losses for the Capitals when they went to the Islanders, and here you go. You're going to find out. But that Islander team's got speed. They've got transition. They've got veterans. They've got young legs in Beauvillier and some other guys, and they can roll four lines. The big question will be, is Semyon Varlamov going to be as good as Braden Holtby? If he is, I think the Capitals are in trouble.
Yeah, what do you think of this, though? The people that I keep talking to on pregame, postgame, Alan May among them, say, well, these are preseason games for them, and we're kind of comparing how the Caps are playing to teams like the Islanders, who were playing effectively playoff games, and that they are playing these games differently. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I do. I think that favors the Islanders because they're already lathered up in postseason form, whereas the Capitals obviously aren't. Now they're going to have to crank it up starting Wednesday. And look, the fact that it's a best of seven certainly helps, gives you a little bit of leeway. But you better not take that team lightly just because you avoided Carolina. I think it's a better matchup for Washington than Carolina would have been, but I think you're sleeping on the fact if you think that the Islanders don't have, again, that speed in transition that a team like Carolina has. They don't have as much of it, but they have speed in transition and skill players. Jordan Eberle, if guys like that are on, which they were last year in the first round, leading to a four-game sweep, if they're on, they can absolutely take advantage of this Capitals team. However, you hope that by winning yesterday and by beating a pretty good team in Boston, granted, Boston struggled so far in their four games in Toronto, including a pre-game, if that finally helped kind of feel, allow them to feel a little bit more comfortable and get a little more oil running through the engine, hopefully that translates to a good, strong game one. But they better stay out of the damn box. You're not going to kill off 5-6 penalties a game like they had to against Philadelphia. And again, you better score on the power play. Otherwise, you've got no shot of beating a team as deep and as good as the Islanders.
Russell, you're always a good matchup. Thank you, buddy. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, fellas. Appreciate you.
Let's talk a little baseball, Tommy. Byron Kerr, Massin Sports, covers these Nationals. Byron, we'll get to Sean Doolittle here in a second, but this team is not scoring runs. Their home run leader is a part-time player and Michael A. Taylor with two. Nobody else has more than one. A couple players have two less themselves than the Nationals do as a team. They're last in the league in runs. Where's the offense going to come from?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem right now. Trey Turner and Adam Eaton at the top of the lineup were batting around 200 to begin this season. They weren't getting many guys on base. Juan Soto, as you said, wasn't available. Eric Thames says a 92-mile-per-hour fastball looked like a 98-mile-per-hour fastball. Those guys aren't hitting home runs like they normally do. Soto's obviously back. He's starting to hit home runs, so that will help. But, yeah, the offense is down. I mean, Howie Kendrick hasn't been what he was. Obviously, the loss of Anthony Rendon is big because Carter Kieboom is doing a great job of getting on base. But right now, they just don't have much power, which is something that the Nationals were used to all these years. They were a power-based team. Even Ryan Zimmerman was hitting home runs. Matt Adams, those guys from last year, and Anthony Rendon. And, they just haven't got off to a good start offensively. And that has affected games where they don't have margin for error for their pitching staff, which, would give up a couple of runs here and there in years past, and the offense would roll late in the late innings and come back and win it for them. So it's a problem that's creating issues on not only the offensive side, but on the defense, the pitching and defensive side too, where both sides are not pulling the rope hard enough for them to score more runs and to win games.
Byron, if they hadn't extended the playoffs, they might already be in really, really bad shape. Luckily, there are three extra teams that are going to get in, so they'll have a shot possibly to be a postseason team. But I guess right now the concern is just getting right. What is your level of worry for this team with so little going according to plan?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Mike Rizzo's confident that Sean Doolittle will figure out a way to get some of his velocity back, but that's concerning for me because he says that, he doesn't feel like there's anything mechanically wrong, but yet his velocity is way, way down. And when you're a two-pitch pitcher and you're not getting your velocity up, you're not getting that high fastball in the mid-90s, where guys reach up and try to swing at it, then that becomes a concern for the end of games because, Daniel Hudson, as we saw the other day, can't do it all. Will Harris, so we're going to speak to him on a Zoom call later today, see how he's doing on recovery. He wasn't as advertised as coming from Houston as they were expecting him to shut down the end of things. So that's a concern. And then the starting five, as I wrote a couple of times this weekend, in their pitching rotation, they haven't had all five guys healthy all at the same time. Even Steven Strasburg admitted last night that the wrist and the thumb still aren't quite 100%. And obviously he gave up five runs in the fifth inning when he got up to around 70 pitches. We still don't know how Max Scherzer is going to do, and they're hoping he'll be able to pitch tomorrow with that hamstring. That's a concern. And Anibal Sanchez got rocked. So Corbin's done a nice job, and Strasburg looked great in the first four innings. And Austin Voth looks good, but that was supposed to be the power of this team, and that's how Mike Rizzo builds his teams, is they need their starting rotation to keep the score down, and then the offense does the trick. So, yeah, level of concern is pretty high because, they have not had any good runs yet, and now they're going on 13 games on the road. And they're going to have to, as Davey always says, pick it up one game at a time, but they're going to have to figure out a way to energize this offense, as Danny said at the beginning of it, or they're going to be in some big trouble come playoff time, no matter how many teams get in.
Byron, thank you, buddy. Always appreciate it, man. Enjoy your week.
All right, guys. You too. Take care.
That's your Beltway Blitz. Next, college football. Not looking good for this fall. We got the latest on G&D.
Not had any road. You know, they're going to have.
So it depends on the outlet and where you're doing your reading and your researching. You're getting various stories today at differing levels about the chances for college football in the fall, but none of them appear all that good. If you are a college football fan and you want to see games this fall, doesn't look like it's going to happen. Via ESPN.com, commissioners of the Power Five conferences held an emergency meeting on Sunday. There's growing concern about college athletics and officials that the upcoming football season, other fall sports, can't be played because of the coronavirus pandemic. ESPN went on to say that no major decision had been made as of late last night, but they have sources saying that in all of the Power Five conferences, ESPN is being told the commissioners have talked about trying to collaborate if their respective presidents do decide to cancel or postpone fall sports. Now, today, Dan Patrick supposedly talked to someone, a source, who told him that the Big Ten and the Pac-12 are going to be the first schools in the first conferences to shut down all the school programs for football, and that's expected to happen tomorrow. The report he had was that the SEC was kind of the last team that was hoping to play, and they were trying to get schools to join them. The ACC, the Big East, some other schools were going to follow suit with these other conferences. Danny, there's a report now out of Michigan, in a newspaper in Michigan, saying that they've heard that the Big Ten's shutting down, and yet you still got coaches like Jim Harbaugh in the last few hours releasing statements saying they want a college football season. They expect to have one. This is a mess, but it does not look like there will be any fall sports for college football fans to watch coming up in the end of August, early September.
Right, that's where it's trending. That's where it's trending. And what I think you're going to see are players, and I think even coaches to a degree, make a big production about how much they want to play and, oh, this is really hard. But, you know, and they're going to make somebody else be the bad guy, right? Because they're public-facing. They want the hardcore fans on their side, and it's very easy to blame faceless university presidents or, like, the guy in the conference office who makes a bunch of money and that sort of that. But this is the trend. This is where it's going. And you and I have posited, I mean, it's not like we have any inside information. We're not public health experts, but just, again, looking at trends and looking at data points, it's really hard to put college kids in a bubble. It's hard to put college football players. The rosters are so big, the dorms, that just what college life is. I know that there are plans that have executed perfectly might work, and I know a couple of players, I think Trevor Lawrence on his Twitter account kind of espoused some of those, but I just think that's a really, really hard ask for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids in all different parts of the country to be able to come together and everybody pull the rope in the same direction for an extended period of time just to get a college football season. To me, this always should have been a spring timeline, I think that's where we're headed in terms of when these games are going to get played, if at all.
It looks like it's going to happen. You know, we talked last week about football in the spring and why the schools don't want it. You know, the ADs, the coaches, the players, none of them want spring football en masse. But if they're going to have it, that might be the only option. Nicole Auerbach of The Athletic is saying that Old Dominion has canceled their fall sports in their entirety, including football today. So they're not waiting for any kind of decision from conferences or the rest of college football. They've just gone out and said that there will not be any college football this fall at Old Dominion. But you're going to have mass opt-outs of the best players on these teams. Guys like Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields who are going in the top five. I mean, really, if you're drafted at all, I would think, or going to be drafted, I guess, theoretically, at all, if you're going to be in the seven, and if they expand the draft, which they're talking about doing because of some of the COVID circumstances, to an eighth round or something, if you're one of the 250-plus guys that get drafted, you might opt out of this season. You might determine, I got a shot to get drafted. I'm not going to get hurt. So you're talking about a very much different, way watered-down product that just won't be the same. But it's better than nothing. So here we come back to the 2020 slogan, Danny. I guess better than zero?
Better than nothing.
It's going to not be as good. It's going to stink potentially, but at least there's a college football season in the spring. And there's no guarantee of that, for the record.
No, correct.
They can't pull this off in the spring if things don't improve and get better. They're not going to be able to do it. So they're going to have a lot of changes made to how the country's handling and succeeding at kicking COVID to the curb if they're actually going to be able to have a season at all in the spring.
No, that's 100% right. But the way that I have seen this, it's always been very simple to me. And I know it's not a simple situation, but my course of action, what I would pursue, is simple. The way I evaluate it is this. One way, no chance. The other way, some chance. I'll go with the some chance. Door number B every time. Letter B every time. Now, there's no guarantees, you touched on. You're 100% right. If things somehow get worse, God forbid, or even if they're only slightly better, we could be in the same predicament when these guys are supposed to be ramping up in January, February, playing games, et cetera. We could have an only conference schedule. Some teams in, some teams out. The NCAA not having its act together. The Power Five not having its act together in terms of uniform standard practices, et cetera. We could be in the same spot with bureaucracy reigning supreme. I understand all that. But to me, I just didn't think there was ever a chance, given the current climate, that they were going to be able to play a successful college football season this fall. And maybe there was some. Maybe there was a small keyhole to go through. But I always saw this as close to a zero within a margin of error as possible, whereas there was some light at the end of the tunnel in the spring. So I was always pushing for the spring, knowing that it's not ideal, knowing that there are complications. But if you want to have one, you got to do it this way, I think.
Jim Harbaugh's statement that he released, essentially begging for college football. I'm not really a Jim Harbaugh guy. But he puts together a bunch of bullet points here as to why there should be football in the fall. He says, I'd like to address the rumors that are swirling today. I'm not advocating for football this fall because of my passion for our players and desires to play, but because of the facts accumulated over the last 8 weeks since our players returned to campus on June 13th, I'm advocating on August 10th that this virus can be controlled and handled because of these facts. He said the Michigan football program has had 11 positive tests out of 893 administered, including 3 upon initial return to campus. We've had 2 positive tests out of the last 417. We've had 0 positive tests out of the last 353. He says there have been 0 positive tests among the coaches or staff after the entire 8 weeks of testing. There has been no contrast. He says there's been no contract tracing to our fields, weight room, locker room, or facility. We have had 0 pauses in our training. We have compiled with and followed all of the CDC guidelines and self-implemented stricter standards for contacting, tracing, and quarantining to preventing the spread. So he's kind of running off all these things and saying, listen, we're not testing positive. None of the coaches have had this. We're getting fewer and fewer cases. 0 for our last 353, 2 for our last 417, basically 11 for 893 overall, including when guys showed back up at campus. He goes on to talk about Daryl Conway, who's the chief medical officer, being a member of the Big Ten's medical advisory group, and the fact that he stated, I wish that others could see this model and the way that Michigan's doing it. He says it's not easy, it's hard, but he is using hashtags like we want to play and we want to coach and he wants a season. I just don't think it's up to guys like him at all. I mean, had, at the very beginning, like Dabo Sweeney coming out. Now, who are the other guys that said ridiculous things? You know, these coaches that were like, we'll be playing no matter what. See you at the 50-yard line. You know, it was a lot of that.
Right.
And it kind of still looks that way. At least now he's got some numbers on his side with the way that they've handled this.
And a couple more bullet points. He's like, we haven't beaten Ohio State. We have one bowl win in all my tenure. I, of course, made those up. But they're nonetheless true. Again, he's trying to look like the hero here. He's trying to look like the rock star. It's the big bad administrators that are preventing us from doing what we want to do out there on the field. So, yeah, I'm not a Jim Harbaugh guy, and nothing about this changes that statement. But I do think it's going to be a popular sentiment, right? Players would like to play football. I understand that. Coaches would like to coach.
You think Trevor Lawrence
I understand that.
Doesn't want to get his last crack at a season at Clemson? Come on. Of course he does.
Yeah, of course he does. And it's not ideal, but you know, again, it's up to the adults in the room. And it sounds like, to me, I'd like to have a coach be in that department, be one of the adults in the room. But I guess that's above Harbaugh's pay grade and the like. So good for him, I suppose.
Well, I'll tell you
throwing
this.
A temper tantrum.
Lawrence himself released some statements yesterday that I actually thought were way more powerful than Harbaugh's that we just read. Now, Harbaugh uses the numbers of the test, but we can get into what Trevor Lawrence said where he's talking about, you know, you're sending us back to worse situations. You're trying to keep us safe. You know, we've got a ton of guidelines and strict rules, and we're living lives right now in somewhat quarantined situations on campus. He says, you're sending us back to a way worse situation where we have way better chance of ever getting COVID and getting sick and having issues. He also goes into guys who have less motivation to go to class and get good grades and get their education and less motivation to better themselves and things like that. So we can get into what he had to say, but let's open up the phones at 800-636-1067 next. College football on the chopping block. It looks like within the next 24 hours, the trending toward that there's going to be no season. Your thoughts on that? Is that the right call? Is there any way to avoid that? Grant and Danny on the Fan. New development scenario of ever getting COVID. Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. You can call us at 800-636-1067. You can tweet us. We're both checking our Twitter timelines off and on, at Grant H. Paulson and at Funny Danny. We've been on record for a while saying there wouldn't be a college football season. It looks like that's going to become official as of tomorrow. According to a lot of the reports out there, the conferences are getting ready to one by one come out and say that they're not going to play. They've already made decisions to play conference-only schedules. Whatever they do, they should try to get on the same page. I feel like if they were together on this thing, either pulling it off or not pulling it off with some type of protocol, linking up would make things a lot easier than, well, the Big Ten did something, so now we're going to follow suit as the Pac-12. We're the SEC. We have to do it that way, and the ACC can't be the only one that doesn't. It's strange to me that they all are kind of governing themselves in their own ways. I get the geographical part of the problem with COVID, but I would think there would be more of a uniform philosophy for these conferences, Danny, that hasn't really come to fruition at any point.
And it reminds you of what college football is. It's the, could you imagine in the NFL, the NFC East having different rules than the AFC North? You know what I mean? Like, it's a reminder of these, they're these little fiefdoms and how protective they are of their little worlds and their precious little rivalries and their own sort of money-making apparatuses. It does kind of remind me that it's almost analogous to our country, frankly, where we think of it as the United States of America. Well, you know, the policies in New Mexico are going to be very different than they are in Delaware, and that's just sort of by the nature of the land, right? So it's very telling that there's nothing uniform about this. Now, it may end up uniformly. They all each come to an independent decision once a conference like the Big Ten has said no. But again, it's just different parts of the country have different attitudes towards everything. And I think that's okay, although you're not allowed to say that, I guess, at this point. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And you're right. It's a stark reminder that the NCAA is basically just a powerless office of like seven or eight people in Indianapolis, and really it's about conference commissioners and all the coaches and ADs making up the decisions for a big bulk of things.
What can't happen is you can't let the players decide, I don't think, if they want to play or not. And professionally, I've been on board with that for a while, and I've been saying, look, these guys are opting in or they're opting out, and there's millions of dollars at stake for a lot of them and hundreds of thousands for others, and if they want to play, they're professionals, they're big boys, they're adults, you let them do it. Well, college football players are not pros, and they're not getting paid like pros. And so it stands to reason that you wouldn't let them make the call. I mean, the NCAA makes so many calls for them. I don't think you could just step to the side now and throw your hands up and go, well, really, it's up to the players, when nothing is up to the players at any point at that level. But this was Trevor Lawrence last night, the quarterback at Clemson, the projected number one overall pick, who, if the sport is moved to the spring, probably will not get to play for Clemson this year. Would opt out of that, you'd have to imagine. He says, people are at just as much, if not more, risk if we don't play. Players will all be sent home to their own communities where social distancing is highly unlikely, and medical care and expenses will be placed on the families if they were to contract COVID-19. Not to mention, the players coming from situations that are not good for them, their future, and having to go back to that. He said, football is a safe haven for so many people. We are more likely to get the virus in everyday life than playing football. Having a season also incentivizes players being safe and taking all of the right precautions to try to avoid contracting COVID, because the season, teammates safely, is on the line. He says, without the season, as we've seen already, people will not social distance or wear masks. They will not take the proper precautions. I think everything he says here is largely correct, for the record. But the question becomes, what is the goal? Is the goal that you need to have no cases on college campuses? Is the goal that having football, which is just college football and it's just a game, I'm paraphrasing kind of this way of thinking, and it's not worth additional cases or putting players at risk, if that's the goal, okay. But he's thinking kind of societally bigger picture about the harm that could be done to these student-athletes as they go home and whether or not they're more at risk away from the campus than on campus using these protocols. I mean, find the lies here. He's not saying things that are that inaccurate.
It's a thoughtful point, but at the risk of sounding like just the world's biggest jerk, what is college football responsible for? And I guess what I'm saying is college football responsible for government and society's failings? Should they be, just for their logic, if they had to defend themselves against this, they say, we're going to be putting people, including student-athletes, including, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who were basically saying, we don't really trust you to make the right decisions. We're going to be taking as good a care of you as possible. That's our idea. And we're going to be putting people at risk. We're sorry that guys may be more at risk in their home environments, but college football is not a charity organization. College football is not there to improve everybody's hometown and build affordable housing and do a million other things. They're there to put on college football games. And I know that's harsh and awful, but I'm basically trying to say, just think of how, you know, the sport at large would address that. You know, they can't be responsible for every kid's home life when it's all said and done. I mean, yeah, coaches should take an interest and help out as much as they possibly can, but the idea that we're just supposed to be putting kids at risk from an administrator's perspective, right? Putting kids not only among the athletes, but among other athletes and among the student body at risk to be able to play these games. And your point is, well, they're at risk everywhere. Okay, but we need to be able to control the college football part of it. We can't control, you know, when the kid goes home. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And I'm on that side of it. I'm with you on that. My point is as simple as I understand what he's saying.
Yeah, I get it.
I get that as a player, you're upset about this. He's making reasonable, logical points. Mm-hmm. My point is they're just working from different end games.
Yeah.
Like what is the big picture goal? His big picture goal is to have a football season. He's starting there and kind of speaking from that perspective. The other one is to say, we don't need a football season. You know, we need to make sure that we mitigate the risk for as many of these students as possible. Now, he's countering that by saying you're not doing that anyway. And I think there's probably some truth to some of what he's saying. But make no mistake about it, based on everything that's happened since yesterday at this time at about noon, it looks like there aren't going to be any college football games played in the fall. But Lawrence and coaches like Jim Harbaugh are going to continue to fight the fight as best they can until that announcement is made official. We've got new developments on the Darius Geis scenario with Washington, and they're not good. There is more detail coming out on exactly what is alleged to have happened between he and his ex-girlfriend and why he got arrested. And we'll have that for you on Grant and Danny as we continue. By saying you're getting doubles about the... And probably some truth to some. Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. Welcome back, and thank you, as always, for listening to the show. It means a lot. At the top of the hour, in about 13 minutes at 1 o'clock, Aaron Murray, the former quarterback at Georgia, was a great player in the SEC and now talks about college football for a living. Will give us the latest on if there is a spring season, what it might look like, and some of the differences for the sport, whether or not there's a chance that any of the conferences or teams end up playing in the fall. So we'll talk to Aaron Murray about that in just a bit. Look, I'll tell you up front, this is a fairly graphic description of what happened between Darius Geis and his ex-girlfriend. There's a Washington Post story, some reporting being done on the charging documents that have come out. So I'm just going to read from that. I have no additional information. This isn't anything we're reporting. This is just straight from the Washington Post and what they're seeing based on these charging documents. I'm sure you've seen this, Danny.
Yeah.
Very troubling. Darius Geis, according to the Post, quote, strangled his girlfriend until she was unconscious in his Ashburn home in March, according to charging documents. When she awoke, Geis, who at the time was a member of Washington's NFL team, was crying and tapping her. The woman, who was only described in court documents using initials, told authorities Geis also pushed her and pulled her hair during the encounter, according to the charging documents filed in Loudoun County General District Court Monday. The incident is at the heart of a criminal case against Geist, 23, released by the Washington football team last week. There are other incidents here. After the March incident, the woman had to leave to catch a flight at BWI, according to the charging documents. She told investigators she was in a hurry and did not look in the mirror until she arrived for a layover in Chicago. The woman took a photo of her injuries in a restroom, according to the charging documents. She suffered bruising to her neck, which also had colored spots on it, according to the charging documents. The same woman told authorities Geist pushed her to the ground outside of the football player's home in April on April 17th, causing injuries. According to those documents, the injuries were not described in the court documents. So some of the details coming out in a developing story here about Darius Geist, former running back here in Washington. Obviously, these are allegations, and he'll have his day in court. But it's tough to even read it and react to it.
Yeah. The accusations and the allegations therein are gory, and it's not a lot of fun to read those. That's not fun for anybody. Nothing about this is good, and nobody should be celebrating. And I think is kind of an obvious place to start. But, yeah, I knew that this was coming in some way. Not the specifics, Grant, but the severity of the allegations. Obviously, we're going to be, you know, just that. They were going to be severe. Which is, you know, I think why once the Washington football team learned about kind of the nature of these things, they said, goodbye, that's it, because of how graphic some of these things were have been. So, yeah, it's not good, and it's tough to read.
Yeah, and this goes back to what we discussed, you know, early in the show, and we talked about the fact that the team acted hastily, very quickly. What information did they have or didn't they? We don't really know. I mean, they talked to Darius Geist. He may have told them that this is what happened, right, when he sat down and spoke with them. He may not have also, but it's possible that they knew that this is exactly what took place, just like the chance is that maybe they didn't and they cut him anyway. This doesn't necessarily change anything from what we knew over the weekend. You don't get arrested for no reason, as we talked about earlier. Loudoun County, as a police department, is investigating this, and before they file charges, they're finding that these allegations warrant spending the time that it takes and damaging the public well-being, not only of a guy like Darius Geist, who may be the aggressor here if it's proven, but how about the victim? You know, a person who, when you're dealing with someone public, you're going to take a lot of unfair and unjust and ridiculous heat for just coming out and telling this story, which is always tragic and so awful. And that's something that probably is going to happen. So they don't handle these situations and go forward with them without doing their due diligence. So you knew, as you said, that something was going to come out. But today, to have this come out this quickly and to be, you know, that, I would say, just descriptive. I mean, to see written in a Washington Post paper tomorrow and right now online that a player who people have been cheering for in this fan base allegedly choked someone until they were unconscious. It's just hard to, man, that's not why you get into this to talk about sports. I'll tell you that. It's hard.
Yeah,
to
no
see
kidding.
That.
Yeah, no kidding. There's a lot of other things that are a lot more fun, believe me, to discuss. But there are a lot of things. It's a stark reminder that you never know. What you see publicly is always just a sliver of the pie of who somebody is and, you know, what they do away from the limelight, what they do away from the facility, you know, is not always how they appear to be. Social media is not always who somebody really is, you know. Public personas are malleable and can be turned on and off and the like. And, again, you hope that this isn't true. And you hope that everybody emerges okay from the other side. But, yeah, the allegations are really tough to read. And, again, there's no upside to this, right? The best case scenario, somebody's making up something pretty horrible. Worst case, I think it's kind of laid out here in the charging documents.
We asked the question in our first hour before this news came out. What do you think of them releasing him, and why do you think they did it so quickly? How does this mesh with that? I mean, does this relate or change anything necessarily from that conversation?
It's not for me. It puts a – how do I say this the right way? It basically puts – more tangible information to the accusations, but that's all they remain at this point, right? They remain accusations. It remains alleged, right? There's still a huge process that has to play out. And, you know, remember, I can't help but keep bringing up this comp, but remember with Reuben Foster, what it sounded like was awful. It sounded so awful. And as things happened, we realized, well, wait a minute, this woman had called, had made up things multiple times in the past and maybe wasn't the most trustworthy person. You hate to do that in a case of, you know, domestic violence and the like, but it has to be said. It's an uncomfortable fact that we have to deal with, and he's exonerated of everything, and all the charges are dropped. So, again, it's insensitive, and I hate going down this road, but all that's changed now are some of the specifics of what the allegations are, and that's all they remain at this point is allegations. He deserves, just like anybody else would, the right to have his story told. He deserves due process. He deserves us to wait on judgment until all the information possible has come out.
Yeah, it's awful. I guess for me, what I wonder in relating this back to what we talked about earlier is, what did the team know when they released him? They made it very clear, even today in talking to the media, Ron Rivera left open the possibility that, you know, maybe cutting him will go down as a mistake. They didn't have a lot of time based on the timeline they've given us. They found out about some of these things on Thursday. He gets arrested Friday, and within hours of the arrest, he's released. I don't know what they knew and what they didn't. I don't know how much information they had. These filing documents come out today. Were they filed today? Did they go public today? But is it something where the team may have been able to speak to somebody internally and find out what some of the story behind the scene was? I don't know, but I would love to have more of an indication on what they knew when they released him. Grant and Danny on the Fan, more on this next hour. Aaron Murray on whether or not there's going to be a college football season next on G&D. Time based on the timeline.
They found out about she gets arrested.
Hours of the arrest.
I don't know
how much.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.